thebook.com.
Hello, it's again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Monday, March 13th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next probably 90 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me to kick off March Madness week. We've got two play-in games on Tuesday, two play-in games on Wednesday. We've actually previewed all four of those already over at bangthebook.com. So if you get a chance to go check those out, try to get in front of some of these line moves here. But we'll talk a lot of March Madness here on Bang the Book Radio this week. Obviously, it's one of the most exciting times of the year for sports fans. We've got a ton of games on Thursday, bunch of games on Friday. And then we'll start to narrow our focus a little bit. Saturday and Sunday, the field starts to get a little bit smaller. And then, of course, we won't see any games again until Thursday, at least in the NCAA tournament. But I do want to mention, a lot of times, and this is something difficult for people to wrap their heads around sometimes, there is significantly more value in betting the NIT, CBI, and the CIT. If you're familiar with those teams, if you know what's going on with those teams, you're going to find a lot more betting opportunities, at least I think, in those other three tournaments. We'll talk about those a little bit on today's show with Kyle Hunter. We'll be joined by him here probably around the 11:30 Eastern time hour. So we got about a half hour to get through today's Monday mailbag segment. There are a lot of questions with that. But I did want to point out that we will talk about those other three tournaments here on today's shows. Games actually begin for those on Tuesday night. So we'll get some thoughts from Kyle on those. Coming up on our Tuesday show, four professional handicappers will join us. Each handicapper has been assigned a different region to help us break down here on Tuesday's show. So we'll have the Midwest, the East, the West, and the South all covered on the broadcast. So that should be a whole lot of fun, hoping for about a half hour or so with each one of those guys. So our Tuesday meeting show going to be supersized here this week, and then we'll see what we have in store for Wednesday, trying to grab a couple more guests to go along with Wes Reynolds. We'll see if we take a break from the college basketball stuff, look at the Arnold Palmer Invitational PGA Tour event. But once again, only three shows here this week. I think that's pretty obvious with what's going on here on Thursday. Games beginning early, I believe 12:15, the first tip off there on Thursday. Should be about that same time there on Friday. So, really no reason for us to try and cram in Thursday and Friday shows. Our guests have lots of things going on trying to jump on some of these numbers, because keep in mind here, not only are all of our guests handicappers, they're also professional bettors. So they're out there. Maybe they can't release a play right before tip off, but they're probably looking to grab some line value on it nevertheless. So because of that, it's just simply best that we do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday here. But I promise we will have you ready to go for March Madness. One of the nice things about the format for Tuesday's show there, with giving each handicapper a region, is that we can forecast ahead to some of these potential matchups. So, for example, when we talk the East region, Villanova should beat the winner of Mount St. Mary's in New Orleans. Wisconsin and Virginia Tech, a bit more of a toss-up. But when we look ahead to this weekend, I can reach out. I don't even remember who's doing the East region right now. But say, hey, Villanova versus Wisconsin or Virginia Tech, who do they want to play? What's your number for these potential matchups? Stuff like that. So that's the nice thing about narrowing the focus with our professional handicappers, is to be able to look and say, hey, Duke versus Marquette, Duke versus South Carolina, what's your number looking like for this game? How do you think that one's going to play out? Stuff like that. So that'll be what we do on our Tuesday show. And today, just a lot of stuff to get to, lots of listener participation here with the Monday mailbag. I'll get into that in a second. And also, I have some very, very hot takes. The NCAA tournament selection committee, the job that they did on also some of the things that have gone on here with the seating and also the pairings for some of these events. And this is something that Kyle Hunter and I had a nice text back and forth about yesterday. So we'll carry some of that private conversation here over to today's broadcast. But before we dig really deep into the March Madness stuff, I want to introduce this Monday mailbag segment. So I thought this would be a good idea, actually a good idea for my buddy Jimmy Doomhands on Twitter. This is something I've done on Fridays in the past, sort of as kind of a last minute type of thing without having a guest. This is something that I want to make a regular thing. What we're going to do once the month of March is over is we're going to scale back our Bang the Book Radio content a little bit. Just not as much stuff to talk about. And then, of course, in the summer months, you're really looking at just baseball. I mean, there are, some things with free agency and the winter sports and all that type of stuff. We can catch you up on that once we get into August and September. But we're going to be scaling back here probably the start of April, certainly into May and June. But I will keep doing Monday content. What I did in the past was I did my MLB segment, The Bettor's Box, every Monday and Thursday. As of now, that's the plan that I'm looking to go with, and then we'll see what we build off of from there. But I do still want to keep up this Monday mailbag thing if I can. So if we do get some listener participation, some listener questions, I'm very happy to answer these as we go throughout the sports betting calendar. I mean, look, for me, nothing ever slows down. You know, I do so much with baseball over at bangthebook.com that I don't really get that downtime. I don't really get that break that some handicappers and bettors do get because they're not out there grinding away at baseball day to day. You know, maybe they've done some futures stuff with college football or the NFL, something like that. You know, that, and that's what they do for the summer. They get everything in order for college football power ratings, NFL power ratings, that type of stuff. For me, I keep doing baseball. So we'll still have audio content here, but I don't know how much we'll have, you know, from our regular guests, our regular handicappers. Some of them do sell baseball, not all of them. So we'll see how that whole thing plays out. But I would love to keep this Monday mailbag segment going here as we keep going throughout the year on Bang the Book Radio. Got a handful of listener questions here. I think I got about 9 or 10 of them or so. See how I can get through these. And of course, we'll have Kyle Hunter joining us here a little bit later in the show. But the first mailbag question I actually got from at Jim Badfish on Twitter, saying I'm statistically over 52% for the year, but can't show a profit because I get greedy and lay 10 units to win one unit on perceived no-brainers and lose 2 to 3 of those a year. How do you mentally stay away from the minus 900 to minus 1200 money line bets when you are 100% sure a team can win? Well, first and foremost, Jim, nothing is 100% certainty here when it comes to sports. You know, we know that. We've seen, obviously, on a very large scale, we've seen the Super Bowl collapse of the Atlanta Falcons. We've seen the Indians blow a 3-1 lead. The Warriors blow a 3-1 lead. So even when you have these certainties and you do have these things, I mean, it happens all the time, not all the time, but it happens with relative frequency of seeing, you know, these games where a team was 99.whatever% on the win probability chart to win, and then they don't. So those are things where you absolutely need to pick and choose your spots. I mean, certainly you want to look for situations where you can steal a unit. And, you know, we had an example with Sports Cheetah buying that Lamar Jackson prop. You know, he basically paid $8,500. You know, to win 10,100 there in that one. And there was some risk involved in that, even though it looked like Lamar Jackson had a very high likelihood of winning the Heisman Trophy. You know, he finished out the regular season pretty poorly. Maybe that was something that would have reflected with the voters if there had been somebody else that was a little bit stronger of a candidate. But yeah, you want to look for these opportunities to make money, even if it's a unit at a time, when you get the opportunity. But you know, I think there are a few things I can point to here. Maybe one parallel I can draw is, let's say you're a card counter. You know, let's say you're sitting there at the blackjack table. You've got a very favorable count. The running count is very good. You're very deep in the deck, good penetration. And you're going to load up because you're in a very advantageous situation. And it just doesn't work. You happen to pull a 16 against a 20. You know that the deck is backloaded with 10s, but you don't get two of them, the dealer does, and that's how it goes sometimes. So even though you get these situations where teams look like they're relative locks to win, there are no locks in this industry. You know, it's just, it's not the way that sports happens to work out. So the way that you stay away from it mentally is just that you need to keep that in mind. You know, there are no certainties. There are no 100% here. I mean, even though, like last week we talked about Oregon being a very, very good futures bet because the odds of them not making the championship in the Pac-12 tournament were very, very small. They had a hell of a time with Cal in that game. They almost lost that game. There were parts of that game where it looked like they were going to lose. And you kind of have your heart in your throat a little bit. And that's sitting there with a plus 170, plus 185 type of ticket on Oregon. And, you know, with the odds that you had coming into that, obviously nowhere near 100%. That they were going to make the finals. So you do get these situations, but you have to stay away from them unless you really believe that there's true value in them. You know, I mean, if you're setting your own numbers and you get to a point where, you know, you're looking at something like a minus 900 or something like that. I mean, if you believe that that team is legitimately 95% to win, okay, that's fine. You know, minus 900 implies about a 90% win probability. So, you know, even then, they're not 100% based solely on the math. They're not 100%. So if in your numbers, it's, you know, a 5% overlay, a 6%, a 7% overlay, if you feel like from a bankroll standpoint, that's something you're comfortable with playing, then certainly you can go ahead and do that. But I think ultimately, you know, I try to stay away from those. I mean, if you've got the bankroll to do it, you know, that's one thing. I mean, we've seen it. You know, David Purdom of ESPN's Chalk Blog has had these posts of, you know, somebody laid 20,000 to win 1,000 on some team, and they wind up sweating it out, or, you know, maybe it even loses, worst case scenario. It happens. You know, if you're able to grind out a profit there at, you know, over 52.4%, if you're at 53 or 54%, you really don't want to go out there and lay those 9-to-1 money lines and just bury your profit. I mean, realistically speaking, up until probably last year, maybe 2 years ago, I was the type of person that when I looked at things, even in money line sports like Major League Baseball, like the NHL, I wouldn't want to look at anything over minus 140, minus 145, minus 150, because you get to a position where if you lose a couple of those, you know, all of a sudden you start digging yourself this hole where you need to be a lot better. You know, that's why those break-even percentages are so important to keep in mind. You know, minus 110, 52.4%, as you go up from there, gets a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. If you're constantly playing minus 150s, you know, you got to be 60, better than 60% to show a profit. That's really hard to do. So you get these 900 or 1200 money lines, you know, they are something that can get you into a little bit of trouble. I mean, and even then, it's even tough to do something like that as a parlay multiplier. You know, if you're playing a money line parlay, you like a couple of teams that are, you know, minus 200, minus 175, something like that. You try to get a little bit greedy, throw that 900 or 1200 on there just to, you know, add a few extra cents to what you win. Those are things that can trip you up from time to time. So I just think mentally you have to understand what the risk reward is, what the chances are of that team winning. Look, 90 out of 100 times, a minus 900 is going to win, at least on average, probably over the long term. But that's also 10 times that minus 900 is not going to win. We are going to lose 9 units, you know? So that's something you have to keep in mind there. You have to weigh the risk reward. You have to weigh it from a bankroll management standpoint. And to me, I just don't think that it's worth it. Other people will say that it is. People with very large bankrolls that have the ability to absorb those 9 or 12 unit losses are going to look at it and say, look, you know, there's just simply value in this situation. For a lot of people, they're not really at that point. And I would certainly recommend, you know, grinding it out, whether you're just a flat bettor, whether you do some form of Kelly, something like that. Just grind it out and look to pick up, you know, small victories, because, yeah, 1 unit is a small victory, and I understand that as well. But I just think that, you know, it's nothing is a no-brainer. You know, you can't take anything for granted, and I just don't think that it's a great idea when you're sitting there grinding away, working hard to turn that profit, and then to give it all away by betting something that you think is a lock. It doesn't connect for me, and hopefully – you know, this is a pretty good answer to your question, Jim, but it just doesn't connect for me mathematically to do something like that. You know, unless you have a really significant bankroll to the point where you lose 9 units, you can get it back. You know, and maybe it's whether you're playing a high volume, something like that, but there are no 100% certainties. That's the biggest takeaway, I think. And anybody that thinks so, anybody that's out there selling a 10-star lock game of the year, can't lose type of play, they're full of shit. You know, they're completely full of shit. So those things just don't exist out there. And no matter how good the situation is, no matter how good things look, you know, I mean, we see it. And I think when you think about minus 900, minus 1200 types of things, you're thinking about stuff like tennis. You know, in tennis, you can certainly get those really big favorites, but we've seen Rafael Nadal get upset. We've seen Roger Federer get upset. You know, we've seen Andy Murray get upset early in these tournaments. Things happen, you know? So there are no guarantees. And that's, I think, that, you know, the biggest takeaway there from that point. Kez2109 sent over a couple questions to me here. So he was looking forward to my baseball talk, which I appreciate. Thank you very much. And asked if we can share some good metrics to use, like the four factors in basketball. This is something that I wrote about a little bit over at bangthebook.com. That's was on the homepage. I think it's just in the MLB section now. Some important stats to know for handicapping baseball. A few things here. For one, Baseball for me is a sample size sport. So at the outset, I have to go off of what we saw last year. So when it comes to handicapping individual games, I'm looking for things like a big gap between ERA, FIP, and XFIP. FIP is fielder independent pitching. XFIP is expected fielder independent pitching, which implies a league average home run to fly ball rate. Now, I have to make some adjustments here this year because last year was the year of the dinger in Major League Baseball. Power was up across the board. It adjusted some of the XFIPs for some of the pitchers out there. It changed a lot. There had to be a lot of adjustments made based on all the offense that came about last year. But you look for those situations where you find outliers, where pitchers really overachieved or underachieved. Guys with high ERAs and low XFIPs are the types of guys that I want to look to back early in the season because there were just things that happened that maybe they couldn't control, you know, became home runs. A guy had a high pop-up rate the year before. Last year, things were down a little bit more. Everyone was hitting more home runs, you know, so pop-ups suddenly became home runs. Well, if it's a guy with a track record and, you know, there are some of these outliers where things just don't necessarily line up, those are what I want to look for. So ERA to XFIP specifically, or ERA to Sierra, which is Skill Interactive ERA, which I can elaborate more on here in future segments with MLB. That's one of the big ones for me. I want to look at pitchers that, you know, did what they were supposed to do properly, but either had bad luck or maybe had bad defenses behind them. Because FIP, XFIP, those are two stats that quantify what pitchers can control: strikeouts, walks, hit by pitches, and home runs. Once a ball's in play, the pitcher has absolutely nothing to do with it unless it's hit back to him, obviously. So, you know, those are things that are just out of a pitcher's control. You know, once that ball is in play, it either finds some grass or doesn't, either rolls through the infield or doesn't, some kind of thing like that. Defense makes an error, defense makes a play. Pitcher really has nothing to do with it at that point. So a lot of times there's a lot of variance in batted balls, and you see that with defensive metrics as well. There's a lot of variance year to year because these things aren't exact sciences. So ERA to XFIP, ERA to Sierra are two things that I look at quite a bit. BABIP is another one, batting average on balls in play for pitchers. If it's really high, generally speaking, the range is between 290 and 310 for a BABIP. If it's 330, 340, I want to look into why. Was the defense really bad? Was the command really bad? He just hit the middle of the plate too much and guys hit line drives everywhere, that type of thing. So that's something you can look to use. You can also use BABIP for hitters as well. You know, hitters with low BABIPs, you know, sometimes there's something going on there. You know, were they hitting too many fly balls? Because ground balls go for hits more often than fly balls. Fly balls go for home runs. Home runs don't count towards BABIP, which is batting average on balls in play. So those are some things that you can look at there from an individual standpoint. Now, in terms of looking overall at teams, Pythagorean win-loss is a big one. I talked about that in all my MLB season win totals, which all 30 are up over at bangthebook.com. That's a standings metric based on run differential, runs scored, runs against. You know, some teams really overachieved. The Texas Rangers come to mind. Some teams really overachieved, like the Philadelphia Phillies. Other teams really underachieved, where they were better than their actual record because they just had some bad luck. Maybe they lost one-run games. So that's a metric that I really look at: actual record versus Pythagorean win-loss record. Also, there's a metric over at FanGraphs called base runs, context-neutral standings metric. It takes out what the context is and looks solely at the outcomes. So like I talked about in my example, if a team goes single, single, home run, and then strikeout, flyout, they scored three runs. If a team goes home run, single, single, strikeout, flyout, they scored one run. All the outcomes were the same. They were just in a different order. So those are things that kind of contribute to the variance of Major League Baseball. So Pythagorean win-loss and base runs are two records metrics I like to look at. There are some more detailed ones over at Baseball Prospectus. Third-order win percentage, second-order win percentage, that type of thing, where you can find some of those outliers where teams didn't perform up to where they should have been, you know, based on some of these alternative metrics. So those are some things that I like to look at. You know, obviously, bullpen performance has become very, very big. We see that with the spending of bullpen of relief pitchers here this offseason, what they're getting in trade returns for trading relievers. Bullpens are going to be extremely significant here going forward. They always have been. But it's challenging for me because I'm a guy that loves to handicap starting pitchers because you've got that sample size with those guys. I need to look a lot more at bullpens here this year, which is tough because there's still a lot of volatility with bullpens. But bullpen performance is going to be very, very critical. I want bullpens that miss bats. That's really important to me. I want guys that don't even let the opposition sniff a rally. Strikeout percentage is a big one for me when it comes to bullpens. K percentage minus BB percentage, which is strikeout percentage minus walk percentage. You know, are they getting a lot of outs without balls in play? Are they keeping base runners off the bags, not giving them free passes? Those are some really important things for me as well, both from a starting pitcher standpoint and also a bullpen standpoint. And then I also want to look at offenses that can get on base. You know, you have a lot of offenses now in Major League Baseball that are low average, high power, low on base percentage. Those aren't teams that I like very much. You know, I like teams that can generate big innings by walks. You know, if they get that double, they're going to have two guys on as opposed to a team that gets, you know, a double with two outs, that type of stuff. So a lot of different things there, but Pythagorean win-loss and base runs are two. ERA to XFIP and Sierra are another one. BABIP is another one. And then, of course, bullpens, I think, are tremendously significant there from a baseball standpoint. Kez2109 also asked me on Twitter if we can get some fantasy and daily fantasy content for the baseball season. I do a write-up every day at bangthebook.com with some daily fantasy tips, so I'll have that. I'll also try to incorporate some of it here into the shows as well on that Bettors Box segment. Also, I'll probably do it more in the sense of looking at guys that should see some positive regression or some negative regression, and that's also a good handicapping technique as well, because my MLB handicapping is based on regression analysis. We've got another question here from DerealJimmer702 on Twitter asking me about, in preseason baseball, is there a trend of underdogs versus known worst teams winning games? Is there value in preseason baseball betting? Certainly there is. I mean, I have friends at MLB Dream Picks, is a guy we've had on the show here before, does a lot of spring training betting. I know at Manitoba Money, who's Doug Carson, who writes some NBA stuff for us. He does some preseason baseball betting as well here. For me, I don't see it. For one thing, it's something that I can't pay a ton of attention to because I'm obviously doing this show and all the March Madness stuff, the MLB win total write-ups and everything like that. I don't have the time to dedicate to it. I think there's value in it if you can get out in front of the line moves. And you can do that if you're following beat writers. You know, if you can get those lineups, get those pitching rotations before they actually get out there. But the problem is, for one thing, we got the World Baseball Classic going on. So a lot of good players are away from their teams. For another thing, when that happens, you've got minor leaguers getting called up to the rosters, guys that, you know, aren't ready for the prime time yet, guys that aren't all that good, flawed players, that type of thing. So for me, I don't see the value in it, but there are a lot of people that do find value. You can get a lot of closing line value in spring training. You know, once those lineups come out, those numbers move rapidly. So if you can get out in front of the line moves, you know, I think that's something that can be really beneficial for you. But if you can't, and it's hard to do that because you have to be right on top of the Twitter timeline all day long, I think it's hard to find value in preseason betting. So really it depends on your time, what you're able to dedicate, how organized you are in terms of who you follow. I don't know of any trends in the preseason. I know spring training doesn't carry over to Major League Baseball. A lot of those statistics either aren't large enough to be significant, or you're talking about Arizona, the ball flies out of Arizona. In Florida, you know, it's maybe a little bit more neutral of an environment, but you have pitchers that go out there and throw nothing but fastballs, want to work on changeup command. They're not pitching like they would during the season. So I just find too much volatility in it. As we've talked about here on the show before, and as I've talked about for a long time, the thing that I want to do in handicapping is remove as much variance as possible. And to me, I just can't do that in the spring training games. So I don't really look to do it. But if you want to, if you feel like you can find an edge, if you can get those lineups and all that, then you know, yeah, sure. There could be value, especially if you put a lot of stake in closing line value in spring training. Question from Carrie_P871 on Twitter. Asking if I think there's any value in playing series winners in baseball during the regular season. I think there is. Yeah. I mean, you know the pitching matchups ahead of time. You know if there are any situational or travel spots involved. You know, for the most part, who's hurt. Another thing, too, is that you give yourself some opportunities to hedge if you want to. You know, sometimes these numbers are kind of thrown up there. They're not necessarily, they don't get a really big handle. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, based loosely on forecasting of the lines for those three or four games, but I think there can be some value in it. You know, again, this is something I wouldn't lay a whole lot of chalk with, because you're just talking about a three-game sample size, and you may have a favorite that's minus 180 who's going to be favored in all three games. But still, you never know, you know, because the thing I've said about baseball is you're going to win 60, you're going to lose 60. What you do with the 42 in between, you know, that defines your season. So there are times where bad teams just win series against good teams, and it happens. And I think that there's some serious value, or I think there's some value in doing it if you're able to project the lines and you see an overlay that works in your favor. You know, if you've got a team that's minus 140 in a series, you think they're going to be minus 160, minus 180, minus 200 in those three games. Yeah, they probably should win two out of three. So if you can set it up from a mathematical standpoint and then weigh your risk reward, that's something I think can have some value to you. But keep in mind too, you know, another thing here, if a team blows out its bullpen in the first game of a series, that can be problematic for you. So yes, there's value, but there's also some inherent risk as well. So, you know, as long as you're weighing that risk reward, especially if you're looking at it from a mathematical standpoint, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, can be pretty valuable to you if you want to go that route. And I think that there are opportunities to go that route. It is something that I look to do, you know, in that Bettors Box podcast I mentioned earlier. The reason I do it Monday, Thursday is because you have series that either begin on Monday or Tuesday, and then series that begin on Thursday or Friday. So I can do some of those look ahead at the series types of things, look at the pitching matchups, what I'm looking for in those particular series, that type of thing. So that may be a resource that's helpful to you if you do look to play, you know, looking for some series prices here as we go throughout the season. A question from Killa_B36 on Twitter. This was one that was posed to a couple of our guests. I'll probably check with Kyle Hunter on this one as well. But he asked, when the line starts moving against you, is that a bad sign? Kind of a loaded question. It's a difficult question to answer because it all depends on where the line move is coming from. You know, if it's coming from other sharp bettors, maybe that can be a bad thing. But keep in mind, too, sharp bettors are losing 45, 44% of the time as well, in some cases even more. So it's not necessarily a bad sign. It just means that somebody else likes the side that you don't like. Sometimes it can be a little bit more of a public move. You know, if you've got Duke and North Carolina on ESPN on, you know, at 2 o'clock on a Saturday, you're going to get an avalanche of public money in a game like that. And oddsmakers may need to adjust to that. If there's not a whole lot of sharp involvement in that game, that's not really a bad sign for a line to move against you because you're against the public, and we've seen that contrarian betting can be something that works out more often than not. I know Brad Powers does that all the time with his handicapping, and he's had a pretty successful career with this. So it all depends. It depends on the nature of the move. If a line starts moving against you in a, you know, a Sun Belt regular season game, probably a problem because there's not a whole lot of public involvement in a game like that. But, you know, it may simply just mean that, you know, some people are against you and they're not always going to win and you're not always going to lose. And that's just the way that it is. But you don't want the line to be consistently moving against you. If it happens a couple times, you know, if you're betting 25 games a week and lines are moving against you five or six times a week, that's not a bad thing. If you're on the right side of the move or you're on a line that doesn't move a whole lot, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a pretty good thing. If lines move against you less often than they move in your favor, that's a very good thing. So it all depends. Depends on the nature of the game. It depends on what time the line is moving. There are a lot of factors that go into it. So while it can be a bad sign at times, I don't think it's a bad sign across the board. I wouldn't paint it with a broad brush like that because sometimes you just don't know what the nature of that move is and how significant it actually is. I mean, sometimes it can be a setup to move to a different number. Such sharp players can come back and hit it on the other side for more money. You know, line moves early in the week can be like that for, say, college football or the NFL, sort of massaging the market a little bit before limits get up to their peak later in the week, looking to get that number down below seven, something like that. And then all of a sudden Thursday rolls around, boom, that number's 7.5. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It may just be something you missed. If you're talking about an NBA game, for example, maybe there was some news. Maybe James Harden's sitting out. The line's going to move against you. That's not a good sign if you're on the Rockets, but it may just simply be something like that. It may not be a sharp side taking a position. It may be books moving on air. One book moved. Another book feels like they have to move. There's been a lot of that in the industry. That was something I read about actually on an article that David Purdom wrote about the tough end to the regular tough end to the NFL season for the books. They're just moving on air. One book would move, they would move. Another book would move, they would move. It was something that they had success with at the time, but it was something that, you know, didn't really help them too much come the playoffs. So again, it depends on the timing, the nature of the move, the sport, how high profile the game is. It's a really tough question to answer. It's simply a case by case basis type of thing. And as you do this more, as you get a better understanding of the industry, I think you'll be able to tell when some of those moves against you are bad things and when some of them are just things that, you know, are happenstance and something I really wouldn't worry about. And a question from Fat Moses 3 on Twitter. A couple of questions here. One of them about bet builders, which is something I've never looked into. I still haven't had the time yet. So Fat Moses, I will check into that probably over the summer and give you a little bit better of an answer on that. But the other question was my thoughts on offshore books having issues with payment processor security. Now, there have been a couple of sports books out there that have had some allegations brought up against them, and I'm not going to name names here on the show. You can find those things if you want to look for them. You know, I don't want to drag anybody through the mud here. Obviously, there are some things that have been out there, and I don't know if they've been, you know, addressed by those particular operators. But I think that this speaks to sort of an overall question there about how to keep yourself safe in terms of the offshore market. You know, it is a gray area. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, you sort of, I don't want to say take a leap of faith because there are some books that obviously have better reputations than others. But you are sort of sending your money out there into the abyss and hoping that, you know, your information is protected. There are a few things I think that you can do to keep yourself safe. One of them is make sure that your sportsbook is a secure website. You know, when you look at the address bar on your browser, if there's no S at the end of that HTTP, probably not a secure website. That's not something you want to be, you know, diving into. That's something that can be a real problem for you because you have to worry about the security of a site like that. The other thing is, you know, cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is something that I don't know how many people are familiar with or comfortable with as of yet, but I think if you can go the Bitcoin route instead of the credit card route with these offshore sports books, I think that that's something that's probably, you know, going to be beneficial for you in the long run. You don't have to throw that credit card information out there. These Bitcoin sites are very, very well protected because they have to be. There's a lot of trading going on of that virtual currency. There's a lot of business going on with that. So there's more oversight. You know, there's really no oversight in the offshore industry. And this is why legalization would be such an important thing, would be such an important step, because you take some of these gray areas out of the equation, like you get with some of these offshore sports books, some of their payment processors and these types of things. So, you know, I think that consumer and customer safety is something that unfortunately can't be guaranteed in the offshore industry. But if you can take proactive steps toward, you know, making sure that you're as safe as possible, that's what you want to do. You know, make sure it's a secure website, make sure it has good ratings from those watchdog sites that are out there. And then also, I think when you can, I think Bitcoin's probably the best way to go, just because I think it's the safest method of deposit and withdrawal. I don't know relative to credit card transactions what the fees are like and if that's something that cuts into your bottom line a little bit. But, you know, I do think that, you know, it is a very legitimate worry. And hopefully we get legalization sometime soon, and hopefully we don't have to worry about it anymore. But for those that have had some of those issues, and again, there are sites out there, and, you know, Fat Moses and I talked a little bit via DM about some of the issues that he's had and some of his experiences that he's had. But, you know, again, just cover your own ass. Keep yourself as safe as possible. Like I said, there are so many gray areas in the offshore industry. I understand that. It's something that, you know, it just is what it is. It's unfortunate. Hopefully, like I said, we get legalization soon, but keep yourself safe. Be aware, you know, make sure that you are depositing with reputable sites, secure sites. And if you do have any problems, you know, make sure that you get them out there as best you can. You know, unfortunately, there's not really a whole lot of people that are going to be able to help you, but if you can get that mob mentality, get some of the people in the industry on your side talking about some of these things, then maybe you can get, you know, some answers if you have been wronged in the past. So again, it was a hard question for me to answer. I wasn't sure how in depth I wanted to go with it. you know, obviously we have some affiliate partnerships here, and we're very selective about, you know, who we align ourselves with at Bang the Book. But, you know, there are just, again, there are no certainties in this industry pretty much all the way around in terms of, you know, picking winners that are locks to win or, you know, security concerns. So just keep yourself as safe as you possibly can. You know, call out whoever you need to call out with these things. Talk to customer support, see what avenues you can go through, all that type of stuff. You know, check your credit card statements, make sure that there aren't any suspicious charges, that type of thing. But, you know, it's unfortunately, it's the nature of the beast. And hopefully we get legalization and some regulatory oversight here soon. But for now, the onus is on us, the consumers, to make sure that we're being protected and being safe here. So thanks to everybody for the questions. I've got a few more here that I'll touch on with Kyle Hunter. I will chat with him here in a second. But, you know, keep sending me those questions for this Mailbag Monday segment. Really love the listener feedback. Love being able to talk about these different types of things. And again, these are questions that I can share with our guests as well. So I can answer some of them on my own, but we can also answer some of them with the guests as well. And in fact, our guests have been tagged in a couple of these here so far. So we'll be able to talk about them with them here on the shows this week. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and bring on our first and only guest of the day. That is Mr. Kyle Hunter. Kyle, how's it going today, buddy?
Going great, man. Love this time of the year. Excited to talk some March Madness.
Well, not only are we going to, like, I mean, when you say March Madness, do you think people sort of have the misnomer of just talking about the NCAA tournament? Because I think there's some madness in the NIT, CBI, and CIT as well.
Oh, yeah. I love talking anything that's going on. So, yeah, would be glad to talk about that. Those tournaments have been even better to me in the long run than March Madness. I think the lines are softer there, especially totals. And, you know, it's a whole different animal. So if you want to talk about the small tournaments first.
Yeah, I do. Let's talk about those first. I mean, those actually begin tomorrow. And, of course, March Madness, the NCAA tournament begins tomorrow as well with a couple of play-in games. Actually, there's one postseason tournament tonight. Norfolk State plays Liberty in the CIT. So we're going to go ahead and fire that up right away. But what are some of the big wagering angles for you when it comes to those other postseason tournaments?
I actually looked in the database here some. As to how teams have done as far as over-unders, things like that, one tournament to another. You know, when it comes to the smaller tournaments, the over has done a lot better than the under. Overall in March Madness, the under has done better than the over in the NCAA tournament. In the NIT, in the last 10 years, the over is 197 and 183. So you would have actually lost a little bit of money based on the juice. The CBI, it's 102 and 95 to the over. And the CIT, now, to me, this seems like just kind of a fluke, but the CIT, the over is 95 and 56. You know, there, I don't think there's any real good reason for why the CIT would have a ton of overs versus the CBI and the NIT. One thing I will say that is very, very clear, these tournaments, if you want to play overs, much better to play overs at the beginning of these tournaments. The NIT semis and finals, those are played in Madison Square Garden, which obviously is a great venue for unders. And just in general, when you're playing in these postseason tournaments, at the beginning of these smaller ones, the teams kind of just play free. They go ahead and pick up the tempo, don't play as much defense. Once you get to the end of it, they actually start trying a little bit more. You know, the defense shows up. Things slow down. So I think the overs early on can be a lot better plays. And then from a side perspective, you know, this is kind of akin to bowl handicapping, because in these conference or in these tournaments, NCAA tournament, everybody's motivated to play. And the CIT, CBI, NIT, you got to decide whether you think the team really wants to be there. And that's really your number one handicapping thing when it comes to ATS. Comes to these smaller tournaments, because there are some really big motivational edges for teams. You know, some teams really don't care to be there. Other teams are really excited to be playing there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, especially when you look at those teams that got snubbed from March Madness, or those teams that won the conference regular season, then lost in the title game. I mean, one that kind of stands out to me a little bit for Wednesday night here, excuse me, is Houston and Akron. I mean, Akron's a 9-point dog in this game, which unfortunately I think the line kind of took away a little bit of value because I would have loved to have faded Akron. I mean, last year in the NIT, they got to play Ohio State, which you get to play, you know, big brother in your home state. That's a huge spot for you. And that game went to overtime. Akron lost, but they played really well in that game. They were not happy to lose to Kent State in the MAC tournament championship game. And obviously no one's going to be happy to lose at that point, but they lost to their rival that ended their home winning streak and ended their NCAA tournament hopes. So now they've got to go down all the way to Houston, play this NIT game. I was hoping for a smaller line there in that spot because you look for teams, like you said, that don't appear to be all that motivated. You know, another thing about these other postseason tournaments is that there's a ton of travel for these teams. You know, you're traveling on the road for the first round and the second round. Then you get to Madison Square Garden. And the CBI and the CIT, you're traveling all over the country. And there's a big-time fatigue factor in those events.
Definitely. Travel is a big thing to handicap in these tournaments. And I think travel has something to do with whether a team's motivated in some cases. You know, if you're traveling a really long ways away from home, you already weren't all that excited to be playing in that tournament. It's like more likely that you'll kind of just not care about that game, just go through the motions. Yeah, I think Akron, I think the line is pretty telling there. 9-point favorite on Houston. That seems like quite a bit to me, but I do agree that Akron's not in a very good motivational spot. I would certainly have to have a smaller number if I wanted to take Houston. I wouldn't want to back Akron there because, like you said, you know, they just lost their Super Bowl game, the grudge match there against Kent State. And once again, you know, Akron's lost quite a few of these finals in the MAC. And like you said, last year they had plenty of reason to get up when they were playing Ohio State, this year less. So you want to look for spots like that. I don't think the price is very good in that one. Look for spots like that, though. There will be several of them.
Another one that I'm kind of looking at a little bit here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong with this one, but I want to go to the CBI for a second. Toledo takes on George Washington. And George Washington, a team that had an exceptional run in the NIT last year, now they're in the CBI. And you look at these postseason tournaments, and you want to try to look at some of these teams that, you know, let's take a look at Indiana, for example, in the NIT. A team that expects to go to the NCAA tournament every single year. You know, that's just the expectation there in Bloomington. It's what they want to do. It's what they're supposed to do. Well, they're in the NIT. You have some of these teams that are just excited to be playing in the postseason. I mean, take a team in the CBI, like Utah Valley, for example, just happy to keep playing games, no matter where they're going. They have a long trip to Georgia Southern, which is tough. But you have teams that are just excited to be playing in the playoffs. Houston Baptist will be one in the CIT. You get a team like George Washington that made this run in what's a somewhat prestigious tournament, the NIT, last year. Now they're in the CBI. How motivated are they for that?
I think the current number that's out there for George Washington is too big in that game. I wouldn't want to lay that many points, 6.5. It's just BetOnline opener. But, you know, I think Toledo plus the points would certainly be my lean in that game. George Washington's had a little bit of a down year compared to last season. They had a lot of things go on with their coach getting fired right before the season. They're better than their record, but you still don't know how much they'll be motivated to play in this tournament, like you say. So, I wouldn't want to lay the points with them. And when it comes to Indiana, you know, Indiana is a team that I would not touch. There's no way. I mean, there's no price that I would take them at there. Indiana's a talented team. They underachieved again this year. I don't see any reason why Indiana would be really up for this tournament. You know, if they come out and play really well, then that's fine. But it's either going to be a pass or go against them for me. You know, it just doesn't make any sense that a team like Indiana, like you say, that expects to be in the NCAA tournament would be all that fired up about this.
One more game I want to look at here from an NIT standpoint, and then we'll get over to the NCAA tournament. And I've got some takes. I don't know if you do, but I know I have some. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, you and I were talking about this last night. But one other game to look at here, Tuesday night, Colorado State hosts College of Charleston. Obviously, Charleston is not a team accustomed to playing in the altitude. So you get, again, some of these spots with long travel, very unique environments. Teams aren't used to going to these types of places. I think those are the opportunities that you want to look for. I'm not endorsing Colorado State -4. I'll be curious to see where that number actually does end up going. But again, those are spots that you want to look for there of, you know, it's just different for these teams. Maybe they're excited to go to Colorado. Maybe these players, you know, would not go to Colorado otherwise. But when you get on the floor and you start playing in that altitude there in Fort Collins, things get a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. Colorado State would be my lean in that game. I'm not sure what that number will end up at. I think four is probably not too bad of a number to take Colorado State. You know, if you look at the rest of the games, one that kind of stands out to me, Monmouth is an interesting one because Monmouth certainly wanted to be in the NCAA tournament. They were the best team in their league. But I still think that they're probably excited to try to showcase that they're a really good team. You got Mississippi going to Monmouth, and Monmouth is favored by a point. You know, there's some of these games where you would imagine that both teams would be motivated. Those are ones that are easier to pass on. There's going to be plenty of these games where you can find a motivational edge. Sometimes it's going to be priced into the line fairly to where I'll just go ahead and pass. And then sometimes I think that you get a really good value on it. You know, even right now, Indiana is favored by 4.5 points at Georgia Tech. I certainly wouldn't want to lay the points there. I'd either take the points or pass. And again, like I said, the over has done better than the under by quite a bit, especially in the beginning of these tournaments. And if you like the over, you want to bet the over right away. If there's one thing I know here, they're going to put out these lines for totals in these smaller tournaments, and these are going to get bet up really fast. So keep that in mind.
I lied. There's one more game I saw that I want to talk about real quickly here in the NIT. This one's coming up Wednesday night, and obviously there's a good reason to talk about this game, but Illinois State and UC Irvine. So last year, Irvine makes a huge run in the CIT. They traveled all over the country. I mean, you and I talked about them on the show here as being in fade spots over and over again, and they still found ways to win those games. They take on Illinois State, who Illinois State, if there's a snub for the NCAA tournament, maybe it's them. I don't know. I mean, it is what it is when you play in the Missouri Valley. But they're laying 10 against Irvine, an Irvine team that played really well in this postseason in the CIT last year when, you know, they didn't win the Big West. They lose in the Big West title game this time. That's a really interesting line to me. It's probably a game to stay away from, but that's a really big number on a team that has to get up in a hurry to play a team traveling two-thirds of the way across the country. You know, that's why there's more value in tournaments like this, because you get all of these different situational spots to handicap.
Yeah, that specific game is a hard one to handicap. I'm pretty sure I'm going to pass that game. UC Irvine plays in a Big West that is terrible this year. I mean, UC Irvine was the best team in that league. They didn't win the tournament, but UC Irvine certainly was the best team in the league overall. You know, Illinois State, you have to say the Missouri Valley Conference was not very good either. You know, outside of Wichita State, Illinois State, nobody was really very good in that conference. And I think that really hurt Illinois State and their chances. It's hard to say where Illinois State's mind is in this game. You know, laying 10 points, certainly wouldn't want to do it. I don't know if I trust UC Irvine that much either. Irvine is not as good of a team as they were last year, no doubt about that. I think that's one of those games that's a pretty good one to pass on.
Well, we'll see if we can talk some more of these spots here as we go throughout the tournament. Obviously, a decent chunk of these games here to be played this week, but we should have a little bit more time next week to talk about these games. I mean, just with March Madness this week in the NCAA tournament, I mean, that's what everyone wants to discuss. So that's what we're going to focus on. But take our word for it that there's a lot more betting opportunity in those other tournaments. If you're looking for line value, and there are some lines out there, as you mentioned with the BetOnline openers, I think carry some really significant value if you can hit those. So, you know, those are pretty good tournaments to discuss here, but everyone wants to discuss the NCAA tournament. There's clearly a lot to discuss here. I don't really know where to begin. I think I know where you're going to begin, so I'll let you have the floor, but it'll be perfect because it'll lead into what I want to rant about.
Well, I mean, I might as well just go ahead and start off talking about Wichita State getting screwed as they do every single year. You talk about underseeded teams. There's several teams that I think are underseeded. Wichita State has to start the list. I mean, you look at any kind of power ratings, there's no way that Wichita State should be a 10 seed. A 5 seed would have been questionable. Some people think they should have been a 4 seed, 5 seed. You know that they're going to be a little bit lower than they should be. Obviously, the tournament committee doesn't like these mid-major teams. I figured they'd be about a 6 seed. And then they come out of the 10 seed. I mean, just unbelievable that they could get that low of a seed. And then – you know, the fact that these mid-majors get pitted against each other, it's kind of sad because it'd be nice to see a team like, you know, St. Mary's or somebody like that get a shot at a team with a big name, but they don't really want that. You know, Wichita State's coach Greg Marshall had some really good quotes. You should check those out if you haven't already. It's interesting how, you know, they kind of ask him, and he said, I'm just glad they didn't forget about us. I thought that they might forget about us and not put us in the tournament, even though they won the Missouri Valley Conference. You know, this is just a year-after-year thing where a team like Wichita State gets screwed. Last year they got put in a horrible situation, had to play in the play-in game, then play on Thursday, and then play the first game on Saturday. It was obviously set up for them to not be able to keep playing. And they won a couple of those games, and then they got put in a bad spot on Saturday and lost. And then this year, once again, they're ridiculously underseeded. I think Middle Tennessee is also underseeded at a 12 seed. Other teams that I think are underseeded, Wisconsin. It doesn't make any sense for Wisconsin to be an 8 seed when the rest of the Big Ten is seeded the way they were. And then Oklahoma State is a 10 seed, certainly too low. As far as, you know, I think the Big Ten in general was overseeded. The Minnesota, Maryland, a couple of the biggest overseeded, in my opinion. And then Butler is a 4 seed. You know, I have to say, Butler had those two wins against Villanova, and certainly that's why they got that seed. But Butler was really inconsistent this year. Some of their losses were pretty bad losses. So I think there's a few teams that were overseeded, underseeded, you know, glaring Wichita State. Oklahoma State, I think, is probably the second worst seed. And then in general, I think the committee did a good job on who was in and who was out. I just think the seedings and the matchups were terrible.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a big snub. I mean, like I said, I guess you could make a case for Illinois State. I'm glad Syracuse didn't make it in because I don't think that they had a resume worthy of getting in. But here's the thing with Wichita State, and you touched on this a little bit already, and I'm going to be a little bit more direct and angry about it. Like you said, we see this every damn year. Dayton is a team that has made runs in the past. They're very capable of doing it. So what do they do with Wichita State? They give them Dayton in the first round in Indianapolis, who, by the way, Kentucky and Louisville are also both in Indianapolis. Okay? So you've got that whole situation where Wichita is going to probably beat Dayton. They certainly should. They're favored to do so. And then they're going to take on Kentucky with a very pro Big Blue Nation crowd there. That's bullshit. That is absolute bullshit for Wichita State. Why does it happen? Because it's all about money. I've said this before with the College Football Playoff Selection Committee. It is solely about dollar signs. Ohio State will make the playoff over somebody else because they're one of the biggest draws in the country. Their fans travel. They, you know, go and run bars out of beer. They'll pay for hotels wherever they have to. They don't care. There are programs like that in college athletics where they just travel really well. Kentucky's got a short trip to Indianapolis. They'll probably end up meeting Wichita State and knocking a really dangerous mid-major out of the tournament. So let's go to Salt Lake City. This is a different situation because you're not going to have as much travel, but St. Mary's plays VCU. Again, two mid-majors put together against each other. VCU is not the same dangerous team that they have been in the past. They certainly could be a dangerous team, and we know St. Mary's could be a very dangerous team, but one of them will go home, and the other one will go home because they play Arizona the next game. Then you've got a situation in the East region where you get Duke playing in Greenville, which is basically, hey, sorry, we took the ACC tournament away from Greensboro. We'll put you in Greenville so your fans can travel to come and see you. And then they put South Carolina, a 7 seed, in Greenville. South Carolina is not a 7 seed. South Carolina should be an 8 or 9 and get trucked by a number 1 seed in the first round. But no. Duke gets either a Marquette team that can't defend or a South Carolina team that can't score. So Duke gets an easy pass to the Sweet 16, and they're basically at home to do it. So, look, I understand what the selection committee is doing here. They want to put fan bases to the point where they can travel close to these teams. The problem is that it screws over the other teams that could have a shot to make a run because they wind up getting put in these areas with these teams that are really good. You know, Wichita State, if they're playing, you know, if they're a 6 seed like they should have been, say they're out in Sacramento or whatever else, hey, they got a shot to come out, beat that 3 seed in UCLA. But no, you get a big draw of Kentucky versus Wichita State in Indianapolis, and NCAA can just keep lining its pockets. It's bullshit the way that they create these matchups. Fine, the fans get to see their teams. That's great, whatever, whatever. But it really hurts the teams that get seated in bad spots, and there are a lot of them this year that were done solely so that good teams could be put in prime geographic locations.
Absolutely. You're absolutely. I agree 100%. You know, the money thing, I think, is even more obvious in college basketball than it is in college football. You look through this whole bracket, I mean, even the other things that make sense as far as it being all about money is you see Kentucky playing against Northern Kentucky, Florida against Florida Gulf Coast. I mean, that was done obviously for a reason. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a terrible thing, given that, you know, Florida Gulf Coast was going to lose to whoever they played against. Northern Kentucky was going to lose. But still, it just shows that it's about money. And then, you know, the Duke point, I think, is an excellent one. You know, Duke got about as good of a matchup to the Sweet 16 as you could ever get. You know, South Carolina and Marquette, neither one of them would have much of a shot at all against Duke, and then Duke playing so close to home. You know, it's really interesting how this happens every single year. And I guess, you know, the fan in me likes to root for these mid-major teams. And I see a Wichita State, a St. Mary's, a VCU, a team like that. And I want to see them make a run. I want it to be fair for everybody out there. And then every single year you see the deck stacked against them, and then they don't make that run as far as they could have. And I feel like this may have gotten started, or maybe not got started, but it's gotten worse since those, you know, those final four runs by, say, VCU and Butler and the smaller teams like George Mason. I think the NCAA has kind of cracked down on that, if you would say, to where they put them in even worse spots now than they used to because they don't want that to happen again.
And I'm going to keep going here. Like, take Creighton and Rhode Island, for example. I mean, Creighton is not a six seed. Ever since Watson went down, they are not a six seed. I don't care what they did in the Big East tournament, you know, in short-term variants like that, they're not a six seed. But, oh, hey, look what we can do. We can put Rhode Island there, knock out another dangerous mid-major. Neither one of them are going to beat Oregon anyway, I don't think, especially all the way out in Sacramento. But still, I'm tired of seeing this. And I understand why it's done, because you want those blue blood programs. Ideally speaking, you get, you know, Duke or Villanova, Kansas or Louisville, you know, North Carolina or Kentucky. I don't even know how much they'd love to have Gonzaga in the Final Four at this point. That's why you put them with Arizona and you tell them, hey, if you could beat Arizona, good for you. If not, we'll take another blue blood program in the Final Four. The deck is stacked against these mid-major teams every single year so that you don't have a situation where Duke or North Carolina or Kansas or Kentucky gets beat. And I understand it's all about money, but that's the thing that's most detrimental to me about college athletics is it's not about the athletes. It's not about the experiences for them. I mean, look, let's even take it a step or a few steps down to the first four games. Let Mount St. Mary's in New Orleans actually go to, you know, one of these sites and play a number one team. Don't make them play each other. Give them that March Madness experience. The play-in games in Dayton are great. It's a fine atmosphere. You know, credit to the citizens of Dayton that go out and support those games. But don't make these teams play each other. Make these at-large 11 seeds or something like that play each other from the major conferences to see who gets to advance. Let UC Davis go and get its ass kicked by Kansas. You know, let North Carolina Central go get blown out by North Carolina, whatever it is. But let those kids go and actually say, hey, we played in a round of 64 game. You know, don't make them play each other in these first four games. Sure, is it nice for them to say that, oh, you know, we got a win in the NCAA tournament? Yeah, it is. But still, I don't understand the value in making one of those teams, you know, with a small athletic department from a small conference, you know, have to go and knock each other out in the first four games. There are just so many problems with the politics of this tournament. And I love it. I enjoy watching basketball all day, Thursday, Friday. But, man, there are some things that just make it really hard for me to like the NCAA. This is one of them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I love college sports. I love that, you know, you're going to get motivated teams pretty consistently in college, where in pro sports sometimes guys aren't as motivated on a game-to-game basis. But, you know, college sports, like you say, you know, it's not about the athletes and it's not about, you know, what's fair to each team. It is about money. You have to know that going into it. I agree with you on the play-in thing, too. I think that the play-in games should all be the, you know, the Providence, USC, Kansas State, Wake Forest type teams. You know, you can't feel bad for a team like that for having to go to the first four. because they barely got in the tournament at all, and you could say that some of them probably didn't deserve to be in the tournament. Now, the 16 seed, the one who wins, it's nice for them because they get to win a game in the tournament, but the one who loses really gets screwed out of it because then they don't even really get to experience it, like you said, and they did win their conference tournament. So, yeah, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I think you and I could probably talk about this for a really long time. I mean, there's you could go through this whole bracket and talk about teams that got screwed and take quite a while. I will say about that Creighton and Rhode Island point, too. Rhode Island made to travel as far as – I mean, that is just a really long ways from Rhode Island to Sacramento. So they certainly didn't give any favors to Rhode Island, a team that's been playing well here lately, and a mid-major team, like you say, that could do some damage if they were in a better spot.
You know, and what's kind of funny about it, actually, I had to give credit to Kyle Kensing, a guy that's been on our show here before. He was the one I saw on Twitter that made mention, you know, of the six teams having to play each other in the play-in game. And I thought that that was a really excellent point. I want to make sure that I give him props for that, which he talked about on Twitter yesterday. How about this Kansas State Wake game? So they play in the first four, and then they don't play until Friday out in Sacramento. Every other team that plays in these first four games, I think this is something that's happened year after year. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't remember off the top of my head, but all these other teams have one day off and then play again. I mean, Providence and USC have to play in Tulsa on Friday afternoon after playing the late game Wednesday night in the play-in game. So I don't know. I mean, there are so many things about this tournament that I absolutely love and so many things that I absolutely hate. And, you know, I guess it's that love-hate thing that kind of keeps everybody coming back to it. Oh, and also gambling, which is, you know, kind of a big deal here with this tournament. So, like you said, I mean, you and I could rant and rave about all kinds of different elements of this thing. But, you know, I'm glad that I have the soapbox and the platform that I do to, you know, rant about some of these things. And I hope that our listeners aren't too put off by the things that I was saying.
Yeah, hopefully the listeners don't mind us getting on soapbox a little bit. I think this is the best time of the year to do it if you're going to. I mean, obviously we'll be breaking down these games for weeks now and, you know, talking about spreads and totals and things like that. But, you know, this is a time to rant and rave about the unfairness of the system. And certainly there are plenty of great examples this year.
I still can't believe the draw that Duke got. I still don't get it. I don't know if I'll ever understand that. But, hey, again, like I said, it's tailored for the Blue Bloods, and that's just the way it is, and that's the way that it's always going to be. And hopefully, you know, we get one of these years where we're all Final Four teams or mid-majors, and, you know, hell freezes over and all that. But I would love to see that, just to give a quality middle finger to the NCAA, because it's hard to find a more corrupt organization sometimes than the NCAA. All right, so with that out of the way, and again, I mean, like you said, we could go on and on about that. Let's look at some of these matchups specifically here. You know, we talked already about Wichita State and Dayton. I don't think we need to touch on that game too much with the fact that Wichita is a huge favorite as a 10 seed. What other games are you looking at here that really stand out to you?
Well, of the first round games, I think some of the interesting games, Virginia and UNC Wilmington. We love these clash of style games. This is a really big clash of styles. Virginia, the slowest-paced team in the country. Them and St. Mary's about the same. UNC Wilmington loves to run. They like to press, push the tempo, high-scoring games. Virginia wants this to be a low-scoring game. It's always interesting when you get the better team, that's the team that plays slower. Usually they're able to slow down the team that wants to run. It's easier to slow down a team than it is to speed up a team. If you're really good at playing your style, it's a lot easier to slow somebody down. The thing that interests me about this game, too, though, is everybody's taking NC Wilmington in this game. I'm going to give you some percentages on these games as we go. I know listeners have said that they like this. 72% of the bets so far on UNC Wilmington and 83% of the money on UNC Wilmington. Now, one thing that I thought would be good to bring up here is I think it's a little bit tough to read what public and sharp moves are now, because I have to tell you, the amount of tickets that are on these games already is really massive. I mean, these games have already done more than a lot of the regular season games do, and the line just opened late last night, and here we are, you know, Monday, and it's already all kinds of bets on these games. There are a lot of people betting these games, so I think the public does play these games a little bit earlier than they do than the average game, I think a lot of sharps jump in right away as well. So it's a little bit hard to tell what's a public and what's a sharp side. But I have to say, you know, UNC Wilmington getting a ton of love here. And in general, you know, if you look at long-term trends, just a long-term tip for everybody is, you know, that trendy underdog play that everybody in the public is taking does not cover the spread nearly as often as the favorite at that spot. You know, if you get an underdog that's, say, 7, 8, 9 points as a, 13, 14 seed, something like that, long-term, they have not done well ATS. So I think that's something to keep an eye on.
I think so as well. And I actually want to talk about the other game right there in Orlando. And the winner of that 5-12 game is going to play the winner of the 4-13 between Florida and East Tennessee State. East Tennessee State's been a team getting a lot of love here early on in the betting market. They were plus 12, I think, with the opener at Bet Online. They're now down in the 9.5 or 10 range. Is that a 13-over-4 possibility right there?
I won't pick it, but I mean, as far as a ATS play, it makes a lot of sense to me. 72% of the bets on East Tennessee State so far, 94% of the money. So the money really likes East Tennessee State here, and that's why you've seen that line move. You know, I think Florida's a good team. I think the SEC is a really bad conference in college basketball. I mean, I've talked about this before. There are a lot of really bad teams in the SEC. There are some teams there at the bottom of the SEC that are just really easy to beat up on. You know, you catch a team like an LSU that's just terrible. You know, you can get to beat up on a team like that. A lot of these conferences, the power conferences, don't have those terrible teams at the bottom of the conference. You know, say the Big 12, even the Big 10, which really wasn't a good conference. There's not as many bad teams at the bottom of the conference. You know, there's a lot more depth there. The SEC, I think that props up the record of somebody like Florida. Even Kentucky, obviously Kentucky has a really high upside, I think a higher upside than does Florida. But, you know, that worries me about backing SEC teams.
Yeah, that certainly worries me as well. And that's something you want to keep in mind here at this time of the year is you have some teams that are probably a little bit overseeded based on reputation or based on conference affiliation. And you know, maybe those are some teams you can look to kind of take a bite out of here as we go along. I want to move across the bracket to the Midwest, look at another 5-12 game here. Iowa State and Nevada. There could be some big-time fireworks here in this game. Of course, Iowa State much closer in Milwaukee than Nevada is. This one's the late game on Thursday night. Tricky little 12-5 game here. I mean, you look at Nevada, and obviously a lot of people don't think a whole lot about the Mountain West, but they're only catching 5.5 or 6 in this spot.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting line. I think that the Mountain West in general is just way down from where they used to be. This is a conference that used to be pretty good. They're not good at all right now. Nevada, if you look at who they played this year, they've only played one team in the top 50, and that was St. Mary's in their first game of the year. They lost by 18 points. Nevada has a couple NBA players in Marcus Marshall and Cameron Oliver, so certainly they have the upside to pull an upset. But, you know, Iowa State plays against good teams every single game. Iowa State's a really experienced team. This is not one that I'm going to be picking as an upset. I think Iowa State will move on here. I like that they're close to home as well. And Monte Morris at point guard, just a tremendous senior point guard to have leading the show. You know, you have so many guys that are seniors on that team. They experienced a couple years ago losing to UAB in that first game, and I think that helps them in a spot like this because it keeps them focused on their opponent.
Any other games in the Midwest that you're particularly interested in?
Well, you know, I think Oregon's an interesting team to look at. The first game, not particularly interesting because I think they'll blow out Iona. But, you know, Oregon probably was pretty close to getting a one seed if they could have won that Pac-12 tournament. And then Boucher gets hurt, and you get Oregon dropped down, and now they're a three seed. I think that Oregon's still a good team that could make a run. I think the Pac-12 is a pretty good conference. So I think Oregon might be a little bit under the radar right now. As far as the first matchups, you know, I think Vermont's a good 13 seed. I don't think the Big Ten's very good. The problem with that game is that Purdue is just so damn big. I mean, they have so many guys on their team that are just so much bigger than anybody that Vermont's ever played. I think that makes it really hard for a team like Vermont to pull an upset in a spot like that because, you know, just the size inside is something that they've never matched up against. It's going to be really hard for them to match up against. I think Vermont is a pretty good 13 seed. I think they're a team that could have done damage if they got the right opponent. I don't think they got the right opponent here.
No, it certainly doesn't seem like it. And maybe that's another case where you try to knock down a dangerous mid-major. I mean, Vermont ran the table in the America East going all the way through the regular season and the conference tournament. So what do? You give them a team that they can't really match up against because Caleb Swanigan and Isaac Haas are just too damn big for them. So, again, done by design, Purdue close to home. You know, lather, rinse, repeat, I guess we could say. How about this game in Indianapolis between the 7-10? Michigan and Oklahoma State. So Michigan goes through, plays extremely well in the Big Ten tournament, has that great story with, you know, the scary plane crash and all that type of thing. Oh, here you go. One of the hottest teams in the country for about 6 weeks in Oklahoma State. Also one of the best offensive teams in the country. They are close to home in Indianapolis. We know the Wolverine fan base will travel. This is an interesting game, and these two teams are going to have to get at it really quick with the first tip-off on Friday.
This is a really interesting game. I'm glad you brought this one up because, you know, Michigan's playing really well right now. No doubt about that. And I think John Beilein's a good coach, has a team rounding into form at the right time of the year. Michigan takes care of the ball really well. Oklahoma State, though, is so good on offense. It's very, very rare that you'd find a 10 seed that is this good on offense. Actually, Oklahoma State, I believe the last time I looked, they were number one in offensive efficiency on KenPom. Oklahoma State is just so good on offense. Juwan Evans is a tremendous point guard. That'll be the best point guard that Michigan's played this year. Oklahoma State not very good on defense. Michigan not all that good on defense either. I think you're going to see quite a few points in this game. The total is set high. Michigan plays slow. Oklahoma State likes to run, so a little bit of a pace war there. I think this is a really tricky game because, you know, Michigan – is favored, and Michigan's getting a lot of the love. 76% of the bets are on Michigan, 60% of the money on Michigan. So you have some of the sharps trying to take Oklahoma State here. I have to say, I think that Michigan is a very good team, you know, playing well at the right time of the year. But I don't think the Big Ten's a very good conference. I wouldn't want to lay 2.5 points with Michigan here. I think this is a dangerous matchup.
All right, well, let's talk about this then, because this is something that can pop up here in the NCAA tournament. Obviously, it fits the mold with Michigan. You get these teams that, you know, to turn a phrase, sort of blow their load in the conference tournament. And for Michigan, they were in, you know, I would think. But then they make this big run out there in the Big Ten conference tournament. How much did that take out of them? I mean, you know, they still have 5 days to get ready for this one. They've got very short travel to Indianapolis, so they got favorable placement as a 7 seed there in that respect. But, you know, how much is left in the tank emotionally and physically for this team?
I think it helps a lot that they get to stay that close to home and they play on Friday. I think that some of the ones that you've seen in the past that have had a struggle there have been, you know, teams that have traveled a long way and then play on Thursday. That's tough, especially if you played 4 days in a row in a conference tournament. Even 3 in a row,
like Rhode
Island,
and
then go out. Yeah, like Rhode Island, basically. Yeah, like you can point out these mid majors pretty consistently, and then obviously, like we said, you know, Rhode Island having to go to Sacramento. I mean, you can't make it much farther than Rhode Island to Sacramento, unless you put a game in Alaska or Hawaii or something like that. I think it'd be hard to do. You know, I think that in general, we remember the spots where those teams that make the 3 or 4 game run in the conference tournament and win it and then go and lose that first round game. I think we remember those more than we remember the spots where those teams kept playing well. And I don't know that there's as much to the, you know, they made a long run in the conference tournament and ended up winning it. So it's a detriment to them is what some people think it is.
All right, let's slide down to the South here because we've got a question from a listener about this 5-12 game, Minnesota Middle Tennessee State. The seeding for this thing is wrong every which way. Minnesota is not a 5 seed. Middle Tennessee is definitely not a 12 seed, but you know, it is what it is. That's the way that they set it up here. At BM Bagwell on Twitter says he's got a Minnesota future plus 42,500 to win the NCAA tournament. When should he hedge? This is a difficult question because obviously you don't want to hedge in the first game, but with how good Middle Tennessee is and what they did last year to knock off Michigan State, you really have to think about doing something here right away.
Man, that's a really hard question. I don't think I've ever hedged in the first round, and I don't think I would. But obviously, you're risking the fact that they could certainly lose this game to Middle Tennessee. It's not going to surprise me a bit. Obviously, the betting market's telling you that. And 70% of the bets so far on Middle Tennessee State, 82% of the money. So it looks like public and sharps liking Middle Tennessee State here. You have to remember, too, that Minnesota has had a pretty significant injury here. Akeem Springs is out for the year with an Achilles injury. That's a pretty big deal. That's another reason why Minnesota being seeded fifth doesn't make any sense, because Oregon gets dropped down to a 3 seed with an injury. Minnesota gets a 5 seed despite having a pretty key injury there. You know, I don't think I would hedge here. I don't think I've ever hedged, like I said, in the first game. Having said that, obviously they could lose. I mean, it depends on how much money you have on it. Maybe if you have a lot of money on it, you want to try to hedge part of it out. It's hard, though, because, you know, Minnesota is not even favored. So, I mean, it's really hard to hedge in a spot like that.
It is. I mean, it really is. I mean, the thing is, if they pass Middle Tennessee State, I think they can beat Butler. I think that's a game that's going to be pretty reasonably lined. I don't know, maybe Butler -1, -1.5, -2, something like that. Close proximity to Milwaukee for both teams. Both should be well represented from a fan standpoint. So if you can get Minnesota past Middle Tennessee State, I think you got a pretty good fighting chance there in the second round. And then at that point, with a 42,500 ticket, you know, the hard part becomes, how do you do the math of them taking on North Carolina, who's going to be a pretty significant favorite?
Yeah, I would hedge if they win this first game. I think Butler would be a little bit bigger favorite than that, maybe 2.5 or 3 points in that game, because I don't think Minnesota is going to be too highly respected by the odds makers here. But still, you know, that's still fair enough to where you can hedge out, especially at that good price. You know, that was a good price being able to get Minnesota at that. You know, it stinks for them that they drew a team that's underseeded in Middle Tennessee State. At the same time, obviously, Minnesota's overseeded at the 5th seed. So, you know, like I said, I wouldn't hedge out here, but I would hedge out if they play against Butler in that second game.
I think it's such a tough spot in terms of trying to gauge a hedge, because, you know, the problem is you really have, if you don't want to hedge in the first round, and I can certainly understand that, you have one opportunity really to hedge, because North Carolina is going to be probably a double-digit favorite, right? Or at least very close to it. So you're going to be chopping into it pretty good to lay, you know, probably, what, 8-1, 7-1, something like that on North Carolina. And you can do it with that hedging margin, but at what cost? You know, let's say Minnesota somehow does happen to beat North Carolina. They face the same number again against Kentucky in the Elite Eight. So you really start chopping into this thing quite a bit, to the point where, you know, it kind of makes it hard.
Yeah, and don't you think that that's part of the reason why, you know, it's hard to hedge in the first game, because you got to think that if you try to hedge here, Minnesota wins, you've already cost yourself part of it. And then you try to hedge again against Butler and they win again. Well, you've already chopped out a decent amount of it. And then you have to take North Carolina, you know, -850 or something like that. And it gets really hard.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just one of those situations where you made a good bet, you got a good price, and odds are the draw probably just didn't work out for you. I mean, the nice thing is, if you're playing a plus 42,500, you probably don't have a significant amount of money on it. So at least there's that. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the tough things about futures, and maybe something that we should have elaborated on a little bit more as we were talking about them throughout the year, is it's great to get a good price, but man, the draw matters a lot too.
Oh yeah. The draw matters a ton. You know, futures can be you can find some great values there. It's always hard to know when to hedge out of them. You know, anybody who's played futures long-term, there's not this clear-cut answer at the when to hedge out of the future. Obviously, if you get a team that's like a huge underdog into the final game and you have guaranteed big money on it, then you have to hedge out. You know, one of the best calls we had there last week was Troy plus 1,400 in the Sun Belt. You know, it's easy to hedge out of Troy when they're favored by a point or two in the final, and you have a lot of guaranteed money there. It's a lot harder in spots like this where, you know, you can't hedge out in the first game, I don't think. You just cut into it too quickly. And then when you have a team that's going to be a significant underdog multiple times, like you said, North Carolina and Kentucky or UCLA, if they played against them. It'd just be such a massive margin that I think you have to try to hope that they win that first game.
Yeah, it's a really tough spot to be in. And like I said, it's unfortunate because you got a great price. You got a team that I think the problem is that Minnesota overachieved expectations so much that they put themselves into a really difficult seed line and then didn't get the help with, you know, drawing Middle Tennessee. The problem is getting Middle Tennessee. You know, if they play a 12 like a Princeton or somebody like that, and of course people do like Princeton against Notre Dame in that 5-12 game out west, you know, at least that's a little bit better of an opponent for Minnesota than a team like Middle Tennessee that's very experienced, very, very talented, dominated Conference USA. You know, that just makes it a little bit more difficult. Anything else in the South region? Any other games that you want to talk about here?
Well, I mean, we already talked about Dayton, Wichita State. I think that's an interesting game, but, you know, that line tells a story there for sure. You know, I think the South region's a little bit less interesting than some of the others. Obviously, North Carolina, Kentucky, UCLA, three really big-name teams here. So I think we could get some really good matchups as you go to the Sweet 16 and Elite 8.
All right, let's slide out west then here. And, of course, the West region has regional games in Buffalo and Orlando, which makes a ton of sense. But what stands out to you here in the West region? Any of these matchups really jump off the page?
I do think Notre Dame and Princeton's a good first game. Princeton certainly has played well here. I don't know. I can't remember how many games in a row they've won, but I know they haven't lost in Ivy League play at all. And I'm glad that they won that tournament. They almost lost to Penn in that first game. I had nothing on it, but, you know, they deserve to win that tournament and get into this big dance. And, you know, I think it's interesting because Notre Dame and Princeton are both going to play really slowly. That makes it interesting to take the points here because, you know, both teams are good on offense, so you could see a decent amount of points because they're good on offense as far as efficiency. But I think the pace of this game is going to be about as slow as any game you ever see in the NCAA tournament. Both teams want to stall. Princeton changed the way they played in the middle of the year. I read a couple interesting articles about this where Princeton, the last couple of years, has played a little faster than you're used to seeing a Princeton team play. Then they had a couple key injuries. They changed up the way they play, went back to the way they used to play, and it really worked extremely well. Notre Dame always wants to play slow. Notre Dame not great on defense. Notre Dame certainly really good on offense. You know, if Princeton's making their threes, that's a possible upset game. You know, I think Princeton plus the points is a lean of mine. I haven't played it. I'll consider that one, look at that game a little bit more. Obviously, it's concerning, though, that Princeton plays in such a weak league. But I think that's a good first game. And I think, is that the game that actually, I think that's the first game of the tournament.
Yeah, unless you include the first four games, which, you know, obviously right. Are kind of an entity unto themselves. I want to go to the 8-9 game. I want to go to Northwestern and Vanderbilt. This one is really compelling to me because obviously you have this Northwestern story. You know, the monkey is off of that university's back. They have their NCAA tournament berth. So inherently, there's kind of a built-in letdown factor of, hey, we got here. This is awesome. I'm happy to be here. Certainly they'd like to show well and win a game, but they draw a really hard 9 seed in Vanderbilt. Now, Vanderbilt, one of the things I worry about with them a little bit, we talked about it already. For one thing, the SEC isn't very good. The other thing, they've had to fight, scratch, and claw for a while here. Now, so has Northwestern. But it seems like Northwestern, you know, with the backstory, with all that type of thing, they were going to make this tournament. Vanderbilt, we didn't really know. Now they have to go out to Salt Lake City and play in the altitude. I think this is a pretty bad spot for Vanderbilt, to be honest with you.
This is a hard game to handicap because, like you say, you could have a letdown spot for Northwestern. I mean, you finally get there. It's hard to handicap how a team like that's going to play. You know, 50%, it's 50-50 on the bets right now. So far, 80% of the money's on Vanderbilt, which is certainly interesting. I think that's somewhat of a fade of the Big Ten. It looks like the Big Ten teams are being faded. I can't blame people too much for that. But in this case, you're taking an SEC team. And also another problem with Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt takes a ton of threes. I mean, they just shoot a lot of three-pointers. That's hard in these neutral spots. We talked about it for conference tournaments. Same thing here in the Big Dance. You know, you go to this place that you're not used to playing. I don't like backing teams that just rely solely on three-point shots. I think it's hard. You know, obviously there's going to be spots where those guys come out and just bury all their threes. But more times than not, you see these teams come in, they shoot 40% from three-point range, and then they can't shoot it very well in the first-round game or second round or whatever it may be on a neutral site. And people get shocked every single year, like, wow, and they just can't hit their shots. Well, it's so much different than what they're used to playing in, and there's a lot more pressure on. So I think it's hard to back teams that are so heavily reliant on jump shots.
Yeah, that's a really, really difficult game for sure. I mean, we see Vanderbilt a one-point favorite. Like you said, money kind of split there in that one. Neither one of those teams really has a shot to beat Gonzaga, though, right?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Gonzaga has a pretty good path to the Sweet 16 there.
All right. Any other games in the West that stand out to you?
Well, I think Maryland was overseeded as six, but then Maryland plays against Xavier, who's obviously got some severe injury problems. I don't think Xavier is very good right now. So I think that's a hard game to handicap because, you know, Maryland and Xavier, neither one of the teams that I would expect to go far at all year, but somebody's got to win that game. And then Florida State gets a fairly favorable shot to reach the Sweet 16 based on that.
Yeah, and Florida State, I think they were overseeded a little bit as a three. I know they played well in the ACC regular season, but again, this is one of those where because that 3-14 line falls in Orlando, Florida State becomes a three, gets to play close to home. You know, they wind up getting Gulf Coast, which is a game that they're going to win. And like you said, they should beat whoever wins that 6-11 game. So Florida State should find its way into the Sweet 16 with relative ease. A couple of questions here from the listeners that we can wrap up this segment with. This one from @Seavert_3 on Twitter. Any venue in the tournament besides Madison Square Garden have, you know, a difficult shooting backdrop that you feel like is going to trend toward the under?
You know, I looked at this a little bit already. I haven't done extensive research on this because, you know, the totals just came out this morning. But I haven't really seen any that really stood out to me. Some of these places haven't really hosted the NCAA tournament very much in the past. Obviously, like you said in the question, Madison Square Garden the best, and there'll be some games there in the East region later. You know, Dayton, UD, has had some really good undertrends long term. I don't know that there's really anything to that. You know, I've watched a lot of games at Dayton. Nothing really strikes me as very strange about Dayton. I know that if you look at the long term, though, games that have been played at UD Arena have gone under very solid, and these first four games have been good underplays in the past. So I guess that's the one that I'd say, although having said that, like I said, I don't really necessarily think that it's a terrible shooter's backdrop or anything like that. It's just, you know, those are the ones that have gone to the under the most, and I haven't really seen any others that stand out to me so far.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these are NBA arenas here in the first round. I mean, Salt Lake City, obviously, Orlando, another one, Sacramento, Milwaukee, Indianapolis, all of these NBA arenas. I've been to Buffalo. I've been to the KeyBank Center before. That's not used for basketball. It's only used for hockey and then indoor lacrosse. But that seems like one that could be a fairly interesting place, especially because when you look at some of these regionals and you look at some of the crowds that are going to be there, you know, they're going to shorten the backdrops a little bit because there's going to be a lot of people in a lot of seats. I don't think that Buffalo regional is going to be a really significant draw. Tulsa is going to be a little bit different with Kansas being there. But one thing I will point out, when you get to the Midwest Sweet 16 in Kansas City, Kansas and Iowa State certainly should have no problem there. So, you know, that may be, you know, one of those games that you want to look at. The other listener question that we had here with regards to this tournament, this one from @Killa_B36 on Twitter. Kind of a broad scale question here, but who do you think is the best "quote unquote" underrated team in the conference, or in the NCAA tournament?
Wow, that's a tough question to answer really quickly. I think there's quite a few underrated teams. You know, it depends on what you mean by underrated. If you mean by underseeded, you could point out a lot of teams really fast. But you know, teams that, as far as odds makers, might underrate. You know, I think that you want to look for a team that is from a power conference that maybe didn't win that conference tournament, maybe it even didn't play that well in a conference tournament. I think that Oklahoma State could fit one like that. I think they could be underrated. You know, 10 seed was too low for them. They get a tough matchup there in Michigan in the first game. You know, I think that you could look at Rhode Island as a team like that if you want to look at a mid-major. Obviously, Rhode Island got shipped out to Sacramento, but certainly not going to surprise me if Rhode Island beats Creighton in that first game. Not at all. And then they have to play Oregon right after that, which is a tough matchup, especially in Sacramento. But I think Rhode Island's underrated. You know, as far as other teams that I think could be underrated, I think SMU is a good team for a six seed. I think that they could do some damage. It won't surprise me if SMU makes a Sweet 16, so I think that that would make them an underrated team in my book.
Yeah, I like where you're going with SMU. I think Middle Tennessee, obviously, is a team that could meet North Carolina and Memphis, and then that might be a pretty interesting crowd there with that one. I don't know if Middle Tennessee has enough to beat a team like North Carolina, but I think that they can give them one hell of a scare. I wish Cincinnati had a different draw than UCLA. I mean, UCLA is just such a tough team to defend. We know Mick Cronin and the Bearcats love to play defense. They can make games very physical, very challenging, but UCLA just runs at such a different pace than what Cincinnati sees in the AAC that I'm kind of worried about what that matchup means for the Bearcats. One other one I think that, you know, could kind of be, you know, sort of in that underseeded type of realm, would be, you know, somebody like Rhode Island, as you mentioned. You know, I they're not going to beat Oregon probably. I wish they had drawn a different, like if they drew Baylor, I think Rhode Island's a team that could knock off Baylor. I don't think they could knock off Oregon. You know, I think they just got a really tough draw there as the 11.
Yeah. And I think they could have beaten Florida State as well if they had been the three. But yeah, it's a tough draw there with Oregon. Yeah, I think those are several underrated teams, and obviously, if I think about it more, I could probably think of more teams that could be underrated. I think, you know, if you look at the bracket, you know, as bad as they did seeding these teams, I think it's going to actually, you know, as much as we hate it, I think it will create some value for people, because some of these teams that are underseeded, the public does like to bet based on a seed. So, you know, if you find a 5 seed or a 6 seed that's overrated, and you find a 12 or 11 that's underrated, you could find some decent value.
Last thing I'll ask you, who's your national champion?
Man, I wanted Villanova to be my national champion. I still like that team a lot. But I think Villanova has a really tough path. You know, Villanova has to play probably Wisconsin in the Sweet or the round of 32 to get to the Sweet 16. I think that's a really, really tough matchup for there. And then Florida or Virginia right there. And then, you know, Duke has a really easy path to get to play against Villanova. And Duke's going to be a hard team to match up against. So that scares me about them. You know, I think that I may end up still putting Villanova in my bracket as the champion. I really like the way they play defense. They don't foul. I don't feel near as strongly about it as I did before I saw the bracket. I think Gonzaga could win this tournament still. I think that some people sleep on them based on the fact that, you know, they're from the WCC. They scheduled up in the non-conference. Mark Few's a really good coach. I know they haven't gotten there before. I think Gonzaga could win it. So I'll say Villanova and Gonzaga are my two most likely.
I reserve the right to change my opinion before Wednesday when, you know, these games actually go off. But for me, I'm looking at Kansas. I mean, I think it was a good thing for them to get knocked out early in the Big 12 tournament. They play in Tulsa and then in Kansas City before they get to the Final Four in Glendale. So obviously geographic proximity really works for them. And the bottom of that bracket, you know, the winner of Creighton or Rhode Island is going to give Oregon a game. Probably Rhode Island will give them a stronger one. That 7-10 matchup for Louisville is going to be brutal. And then if it's Louisville that advances, they'll have to play probably Oregon. Or if it's Oklahoma State or Michigan, they got to play Oregon. That's really, really rough for them. So I think Kansas has a pretty decent draw, at least into the Elite Eight. And then I think they can get to the Final Four in Glendale. And yeah, obviously we'll see what happens from that point. But I think based on the draw for the number one seeds, you know, I think you probably have to look at Kansas having what I would say is the best one there. But Kyle Hunter, I know you were working on a new website. Did you get that all squared away?
Yeah, definitely. Wanted to announce a new website here today, smartersportsbix.com. Check out that website. Certainly some work still to do on the site. It's going to be an ongoing project. I want to have everything ready for next football season. In some of the slower times here over the summer, I'll be working on the site more. But the site is up. It's ready to go. We don't have all the information that we're going to have long term. But I wanted to get things going here for March Madness, and I've got the Sharp Money Report over there that I talked about last week. Contact me still if you're interested in that. I'm going to send you the first couple ones of that for free. You can send me a message at Kyle Hunter Picks, or also now Kyle at smartersportspicks.com. This is something where the Sharp Money Report, I'm going to look to give you information where to see where the sharp money is going, and then I'll give you my analysis as to why I believe that it's happening and my lean on the game. Those are not my premium plays. Those are just insight into premium data. And then the other thing I wanted to announce here today is a bracket challenge. If you go over to smartersportspicks.com, click on the 2017 bracket challenge. I'm actually loading that up right after we get done here. We're going to have a group that you can sign up for that. And then the winner of that will be $100 cash, second place, $50. The only thing you have to do is sign up for free at smartersportspicks.com for the free picks area. So nothing money-wise put into that, and some decent prizes there if you are interested in joining that contest.
Well, certainly best of luck to you with the new website. Again, that's Kyle Hunter of smartersportspicks.com. Kyle, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. I know I kept you a long time here, so thanks for joining us for the ride, and I'll talk to you again next week.
No problem. Looking forward to it.
A lot of stuff there with Kyle Hunter again of smartersportspicks.com. Coming up on our Tuesday show, 2 hours of March Madness coverage. We'll see if I can get some of that NIT, CBI, CIT stuff in there. I will try to do that as time permits. But four professional handicappers will join us. Each one has a region to talk about, so maybe we can touch on some of those other smaller postseason tournaments. But Brad Powers of bradpowersports.com, and then Sports Cheetah, Brian Leonard, and Ralph Michaels, all from wagertalk.com, will join us on our Tuesday show. Make sure you send me those Monday mailbag questions for next week at Skating Tripods on Twitter or at Bang the Book on Twitter. Head on over to bangthebook.com. Check out my season win totals. NBA and NHL situational betting articles are up over there. We are going to preview every March Madness game at bangthebook.com. I have the first four up already, working on the rest of them here this afternoon, this evening, and into tomorrow. Going to try and give every game 48 hours lead time if we can. So you can check all those out over at bangthebook.com. Sign up at DSI Sportsbook. Use that promo code BTBRadio. $10 free bet just for signing up. Additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. So I'll do it for today. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.